Jackson's front door often slept, and trash was piled up among the high weeds surrounding the structures. With contraband hidden by friends in the weeds just beyond the walls, two prisoners would sneak out and walk around the perimeter of the circular in opposite directions to conduct counter-surveillance. From inside a cell, a matchbox propelled via a slingshot-type device fashioned by the prisoners would fall at the feet of one of the men on the outside. He would then pretend to bend down to tie his shoelace and tie the newspaper or other contraband to the line to be reeled in. To pass the time, the techs made a Monopoly board and taught fellow prisoners the game. "Wally had a bunch of Cuban friends who regularly came in to use our Monopoly set," remembered Andy, "and one day all the pieces came flying out of the cell and there was a lot of shouting. What happened was Ernesto, a civil engineer who built the tunnels in downtown Havana, landed where someone had about four hotels. He just exploded, refused to pay the rent, and almost destroyed the set." Andy fabricated a slide rule from a discarded cigar box and worked on logarithms from an old engineering text he found scattered amid the trash. Then the text created a radio. Someone in the prison had smuggled in an earpiece, and amid the garbage-strewn jail, they had managed to scrounge up a few Russian-made transistors, along with pieces of medical tubing used for intravenous feeding that could be used as additional earpieces. The tuning coil was created by wrapping copper wire around the cardboard cylinder from an empty roll of toilet paper. A battery to power the radio remained a problem. A battery is two dissimilar metals and electrolyte. We had copper from wiring that we ripped out of the walls and tin from galvanized pails, but we needed an electrolyte, explained Andy. So we sent a guy to the hospital claiming he was sick, and he came back with a bottle of copper sulfate to treat the alleged ailment. It's a good thing the guards didn't make him drink it. When the crudely assembled materials were combined with the copper sulfate, the battery produced enough current to power the radio. Another problem was the lack of a soldering iron. All the wires in the makeshift radio had to be tightly twisted together for a high-resistance contact. The antenna was another challenge. Consisting of a length of wire several hundred feet long, prisoners managed to undo a section of corrugated roof on the top tier to string the antenna along the outside. When finally assembled, the radio could pick up broadcasts from WKWF, overlooking the beautiful Florida Keys, and a high-powered 50,000-watt New Orleans station. Among the news items that the techs particularly remembered was Roger Maris hitting his 61st home run and John Glenn becoming the first American to orbit the Earth in space. "I used to go up to the roof at night for best reception," said Andy. "With those four tubes coming out of the radio, I heard American music for the first time in months." Because of the constant danger of Javios, prison snitches, the radio remained a closely guarded secret. Rumors of a radio prompted a requisa, but the radio itself was never discovered. With communication to the outside world established, the prisoners started an underground prison newspaper. "One of the Cuban prisoners was a radio operator," recalled Wally. "He was skilled at tuning the radio to find just the right sensitive spots. Once he got a station, he and an assistant, a stenographer who had been a legal secretary, worked with him. They would plug in the earphones and take down the news in shorthand from whatever station could be heard. The next morning, a copy of the handwritten newspaper would be circulated among the prisoners." On April 14, 1961, the three imprisoned techs went to bed as usual, only to be awakened before dawn by the sound of gunfire and tracer rounds from 50-caliber machine gun fire lighting the building. The invasion by Cuban exiles at the Bay of Pigs had begun. Throughout the winter, rumors of a possible invasion had circulated, and now it was happening. The prison burst into chaos as a B-26 from the CIA-trained anti-Castro invasion force flew overhead, and a few days later, on April 17th, an invasion force landed on Cuba's western shore at the Bay of Pigs. Conceived during the Eisenhower administration, the invasion by 1,400 Cuban nationals was launched with the approval of President Kennedy. Originally proposed for an area known as Trinidad, in the shadow of Cuba's Escambray Mountains, the plan called for a relatively small invasion force to spark an uprising among the Cuban population. If the revolt proved unsuccessful, the invading forces would then retreat into the mountains to wage guerrilla warfare. However, in March 1961, Kennedy called the plan too spectacular and changed the landing site several times before finally settling on the less-than-ideal Bay of Pigs, a location surrounded by swamps. Then, as the ships carrying the members of the Cuban 2506 Assault Brigade approached the island, President Kennedy called off the scheduled second and third waves of airstrikes that would destroy the remaining planes of Cuba's small air force. Spared from those strikes, Castro's air force was able to sink the brigade's supply ship, the Houston. With the invaders unable to establish a beachhead and without resupply or air support, failure was inevitable. On the second day of fighting, the techs began to notice Cuba militiamen loading boxes into a utility tunnel under circulars 3 and 4. There was no explanation for the activity until the bottom of one of the boxes broke and the prisoners could see it was dynamite. Apparently fearful that a mass escape would liberate inmates to join the invasion, Castro ordered the prison booby-trapped. In the dictator's mind, it was better to bring down the structures, killing all 6,000 men inside, than risk a small army of prisoners marching on Havana. By April 19th, the invasion was defeated. Of the Cubans who landed, 1,189 fighters were captured, and a small number escaped back to the sea. When news of the failed assault eventually reached the prison, no hope was held for a second attempt. Nothing more was thought of the dynamite until Thanksgiving Day in 1961, when guards began drilling holes in circulars 3 and 4 with jackhammers. Andy and Dave, assigned to work details clearing the debris, watched as crews drilled into the support columns of the two buildings. After 3 weeks, with the holes completed, trucks arrived and boxes labeled Mech Explosiva, explosive fuse, were unloaded into the holes. More boxes followed, these with TNT stenciled across the side. Judging from the number of cartons, the three Americans estimated that 5 tons of explosives were now underneath the circulars. Ominously, as the explosives were unloaded, some prisoners received black plastic rings with their prison numbers on them. Other inmates were tattooed. Reportedly, this was done to identify bodies if the prison was brought down. Apparently, Castro was still fearful of a prison revolt. The idea of living in a mined building did not appeal to the techs. As word spread throughout the circulars that the Americans intended to do something, a Cuban prisoner named Miro soon joined them. Miro recruited two of his buddies. One guy looked like the Michelin Tire Man, remembers Wally. We went to one of the cells on the first floor that was being used as a toilet. Servicio is what they called it in Spanish. You didn't linger there very long. The smell was something awful. With the Michelin Tire Man blocking the view of the guards, two other Cubans worked for 4 days to enlarge the hole in the floor leading to a utility tunnel where the explosives were emplaced. The team then recruited the smallest prisoner they could find, a fair-skinned Cuban who went by the nickname Americano. Standing just 5'5" and weighing no more than 120 pounds, Americano was persuaded to squeeze through the small hole for a reconnaissance mission. Lookouts were posted as the young man slipped into the tunnel one afternoon, instructed to bring back samples of whatever he found. Inside the 6-foot-high by 8-foot-wide tunnel, Americano discovered enough explosives to bring the buildings down and 2 detonation systems, one electrical and the other a long length of primer cord. If one failed, the other could be put into play. The young Cuban also brought out a 15-pound block of TNT, which the three Americans told him to return, lest the guards find it missing. A lieutenant in the Cuban army had headed the installation team, and the techs now understood the job had been done well. He was no dummy. He knew explosives, and he knew what to do, said Wally. They ran the lines from an outbuilding into the circulars with the primer cord encased in plastic tubing and the electrical line through separate tubing. When we understood what he'd done, we were left there scratching our heads. We're sitting on this thing, and if it goes bang, we're dead. Clearly, something had to be done, but it was not a simple matter of cutting both lines. Cutting the primer cord line would likely tip off the guards who would notice the slack at the detonation station. Severing the electrical line could also alert guards if they ran a test current through the system. The trick was to disable both systems without leaving any trace of sabotage. Technically, the operation was not difficult. Under normal circumstances, with a TSD toolkit, disabling the bomb would have taken minutes. But the techs only had a few simple knives, sewing kits, and razor blades. The electrical line looked like European cable, something like zip cord, AC cord. But it was built differently. The two conductors were a little bit separated, said Wally. We came up with the idea to cut the plastic and then twist it. That creates a short. And when you've got a short, it won't go. You try to energize the blasting cap, and it won't fire. The solution the techs devised was the electrical equivalent of putting a very tight knot in a length of garden hose. However, if interrupting the electrical current was relatively easy, the primer cord was a much more difficult matter. The Cubans were certain to notice if tension in the cord was released, so severing the line was not an option. The trick would be to create a gap in the primer cord while maintaining tension along its entire length. For this, the techs fashioned a special gadget that comprised a spool from a sewing kit and pins. By first cutting the cord, then inserting each end into the center of the spool, they could hold both ends in place with needles and pins. This would create a gap while maintaining tension along the line. Because none of the techs was small enough to fit through the hole, and any effort to enlarge it further would attract notice of the guards, Americano was again recruited to go back into the utility tunnel for the sabotage mission. Over 4 nights, working in the tech's cells in semi-darkness, Americano trained for the mission. Using a sharp knife, he practiced exposing the wires and shorting out the line before slipping the insulation back over the exposed wires. Then he practiced with the makeshift thread spool and pins. Once in the tunnel, he would have only one chance to perform these acts perfectly and under time restrictions, beginning in the afternoon until just before the evening headcount. When the three Americans felt confident in his ability, Americano slipped into the hole. After a few tense hours, he re-emerged and reported to Miro that the mission had been a success. But, to the dismay of the techs, word about the operation spread. One prisoner ran up to the Americans, thanking them for what they had done. Fortunately, the guards never discovered the sabotage plan, or, if they suspected something, did not report it to their superiors. There was no requisa, the three techs were never questioned, and the sabotaged system remained in place. If and when they pulled the switch, we felt that would give us about 20 minutes before the guards realized what was happening, said Wally. Then it became a case of breaking out. How the hell are we going to get out of there? Well, some of the Cubans had bars cut and whatever, but how many guys are you going to get out through a small window? Not too many. We'd have to go out through the front door. Emboldened, the three Americans began thinking of weaponry they could have on hand if things came to a head between the prisoners and the guards. The first idea involved a flamethrower. Wally disassembled an old kerosene stove and spent 4 days grinding the brass valves using marble dust and toothpaste. Ultimately, his efforts came to naught when the stove consistently lost the pressure necessary for the flamethrower to operate. Undeterred, one prisoner came up with the idea of making alcohol for Molotov cocktails. Fruit was collected, oranges, grapefruits, mangoes, and watermelons, and put into glass jars with water and sugar to distill. Then the extract was run off and cooked in a pressure cooker, the vapors run through a length of plastic tubing. The distillate was passed through the homemade still 2 or 3 times. We got the chief chemist from Bacardi, who was in the lockup with us, and we got some of the white lightning, handed it to him, and asked his professional opinion, said Wally. He said, "Yeah, man, this is good 95 proof." He took the gallon of alcohol and disappeared. 3 days later, we're all standing around, leaning over the edge, smoking cigarettes and talking about this and that, and he comes over and hands me a cup. I look at it. Nice appearance. I taste it, and goddamn, it's good Courvoisier. I asked him how he got the color. "Shoe polish," he said. The techs also improvised hand grenades. Americano was sent back down into the utility tunnel for some blasting caps and a small quantity of TNT. Melting down the TNT in a double boiler, they poured the liquefied explosive into condensed milk cans filled with nails, glass, and anything else that would serve as shrapnel. Blasting caps were attached to the top, along with a length of homemade fuse. Fuses for the grenades were created out of match heads ground into powder and impregnated into cloth. Andy, the true engineer among the three, set up a test program. A tech stood on the fifth floor, lit a fuse, and threw it over the side. A cooperating prisoner below would pick it up without attracting the guard's attention and report how much of the fuse was burned. Eventually, the techs determined that 3 inches of fuse would burn in about 20 seconds before igniting the blasting cap. Although day-to-day life in prison did not improve significantly, these acts of defiance, building the radio, diffusing the explosives, creating a small arsenal, encouraged and boosted morale among the techs and like-minded prisoners. The TSD techs were helpless observers in the fall of 1962, when tensions between Cuba, the United States, and the Soviet Union escalated into an international nuclear crisis. An overflight of Cuba by an agency U-2 in June indicated the Cubans were preparing for installation of surface-to-air missiles, although no missiles were seen. Subsequently, U.S. intelligence observed both military advisors and equipment arriving in Cuba at unprecedented rates. U-2 overhead photography continued to confirm activity during September, including evidence that Soviet short- and intermediate-range missiles were about to be introduced on the island. President Kennedy issued a national military alert on October 19th and addressed the world on October 22nd, explaining that the USSR and Cuba had conspired to install missile bases with the purpose to provide a nuclear strike capability against the Western Hemisphere. The threat of an international nuclear confrontation continued until October 28th, when the Soviets agreed to remove their missiles from Cuba. The world breathed a sigh of relief that nuclear war had been avoided, and on Christmas Day 1962, word began to circulate that a prisoner exchange was in the works. On March 16, 1963, James B. Donovan visited the prison. A New York-based lawyer specializing in insurance, Donovan, no relation to OSS General William Donovan, had served in the OSS as general counsel and then as a member of the U.S. prosecution team during the Nuremberg trials of Nazi war criminals. In the years that followed, Donovan kept a hand in the intelligence business, and at the request of the New York Bar Association, defended Soviet spy Rudolf Abel, then, several years later, negotiated Abel's exchange for U-2 pilot Francis Gary Powers. By the time Donovan arrived at the prison, he had already bartered the release of the Cuban members of the 2506 Assault Brigade and was optimistic about his chances for negotiating the release of Wally, Dave, and Andy. "Donovan came down to see us and brought his son," Andy recalled. "We understood he was someone Castro apparently trusted not to attempt to undermine the Cuban government. So the Cubans let him in, and he insisted on seeing all of the Americans. I don't know if the place was bugged where we talked, but we acted like it was and were very discreet in what we said. I got the signals from him that they were working on it, and don't worry, we'll take care of you. We took his actions as meaning that something was going on, but you also heard so many rumors and gossip, you didn't take anything at face value." A little more than a month later, on April 21st, 1963, Wally, Dave, and Andy, along with 18 other prisoners, were told to gather up their belongings. They were transported back to La Cabana and released in exchange for 4 Cuban nationals held in New York on charges of sabotage conspiracy. Taking off from Havana for Florida's Homestead Air Force Base, they were well into the air when a CIA medical officer told Wally that his mother had died. The news touched the deepest emotions of the techs who endured 2.5 years of deprivation and uncertainty. They cried together. When the plane's hatch opened to a media pack on Homestead's tarmac, the American soldier of fortune, Pecoraro, was the first to step off the plane to freedom. The 3 techs, to avoid the cameras, lingered behind the others and were then hustled away to a nearby safe house to see their families, receive medical attention, and undergo the obligatory debriefings. The techs had been in captivity for 949 days, and for the entire time, their cover and aliases held. In prison, They had refrained from discussing the operation or personal reminiscences about home and family, lest other inmates overhear the conversation and their cover stories erode. Yet within days of their return, someone whispered to the press that the three American tourists held in Castro's prison were, in fact, CIA officers. The CIA debriefings lasted for about a week. They were interviewed by psychologists, counterintelligence officers, debriefers, and subjected to polygraph examinations. Personal security became a concern after their identities were leaked to the press. During the summer of 1963, the techs waited for the phone call that would return them to duty. Wally went north to be near his father, while Andy was sent to a fishing camp in Florida owned by agency retirees. Dave remained in the Washington area. Eventually certified fit for duty, the three returned to new assignments in the fall of 1963. Dave Crist, against his preference, was transferred to the Office of Research and Development in the newly formed Directorate of Science and Technology. Andy and Wally continued working in TSD. Andy became head of an equipment testing and certification unit at the OTS laboratory, while Wally remained in audio operations. TSD Chief Seymour Russell told Andy that he should not expect to be treated any differently from other techs. He would be judged on the quality of his future work, not the past. Initially, even within TSD, the returnees were avoided by some of their colleagues, and business was conducted around them. The only senior agency official who formally acknowledged what the techs had endured was Executive Director Lyman Kirkpatrick during a brief meeting with them in his office. Quietly, each received a one-grade promotion, but otherwise, for the official bureaucracy, their nearly 3 years spent in a Cuban prison never happened. Crist, seeking no personal recognition, submitted a lengthy and comprehensive recommendation to CIA management in late 1964 that Andy and Wally be given the highest possible agency award for the courage, imagination, and fortitude they exhibited during the ordeal. The recommendation was ignored, and Crist retired in 1970. When Andy announced his intention to retire from the agency in 1979, David S. Brandwine, then director of OTS, conducted a routine review of his personnel file to determine what retirement award might be appropriate. Included in Andy's file was a copy of Crist's 1964 memo. The graphic description of the conditions in the prison and professionalism shown by the techs under the horrific circumstances so impressed Brandwine that he immediately brought the matter to the attention of the CIA's senior awards panel. At Brandwine's urging, the panel conducted a full review and recommended that all three techs be awarded the agency's highest medal for bravery. DCI Stansfield Turner accepted the recommendation and personally presented David Crist, Thornton Anderson, and Walter Zeminski with the Distinguished Intelligence Cross in May 1979, 16 years after their return home. At the time, only seven others had received the DIC in the CIA's 30-year history. The citation for each of the techs read, "The Distinguished Intelligence Cross is awarded in recognition of exceptional heroism from September 1960 to April 1963. During this period, the recipient endured hardships and deprivations with unquestioned loyalty, great personal courage, and conspicuous fortitude. His exemplary conduct as a professional intelligence officer was highlighted by his unswerving devotion to the agency and by his disregard for his own personal safety in order to assist others. The recipient's performance in this instance reflects the highest credit on him and the federal service." While the three techs were finding ways to survive in prison, the CIA and TSD were planning to eliminate the Castro government. Both the Eisenhower and Kennedy administrations pushed the agency to develop new capabilities for dealing with what was seen as an intolerable political problem in Cuba. Rather than test the international consequences of a military invasion, both presidents turned to the CIA for secret and covert means to accomplish a policy objective. The CIA's Directorate of Plans developed two parallel paths to solving the Cuba problem. Support from the TSD was sought for both plans. Beginning in March 1960, the United States began equipping and training an indigenous secret army composed of Cuban exiles and former Batista supporters to invade the island. The second path, direct action against Castro himself, was aimed at incapacitating or killing the Cuban revolutionary. TSD specialists trained the Cuban exile army in clandestine skills needed for a sustained guerrilla war. The Cubans were taught clandestine photography and film processing, secret writing, signaling, and use of cover and alias documentation. TSD issued a numbered identity kit to each of the trainees and indirectly created the exile army's name. By selecting the number 2050 for the first card, with all others following in numerical order, a TSD tech reasoned that Castro's intelligence service would think the force was larger than it actually was. Then, when recruit number 2056, Jose Santiago, died a few weeks later in a training accident, the Cubans adopted the name Brigada 2056, or later, more formally, the Brigado de Asalto 2056, in honor of their fallen colleague. The only TSS-TSD-OTS officer killed in the line of duty between 1947 and 2008 was a casualty of anti-Castro operations. 4 days before the Bay of Pigs invasion, TSD explosives experts were training members of the Force of Cuban Nationals in constructing and arming small charges for harassment and sabotage operations. As Nels Benny Benson, a 45-year-old native of Eagle Bend, Minnesota, and one of TSD's experienced explosives officers, demonstrated how to mold a charge composed of thermite and C4 into a form that resembled a soap dish, an errant spark ignited the materials. The resulting fire threatened to spread to adjacent explosives. Benson immediately picked up the flaming mixture and carried it away from the site. Critically burned, he died in a Miami hospital 3 weeks later. One of nearly 100 stars chiseled into the granite wall of the lobby of the original CIA headquarters building commemorates the life and sacrifice of Benny Benson, who died doing what duty demanded. The CIA's other solution to the Castro problem drew TSD into the ultimately objectionable policy of sanctioned assassination. Both TSD's chemistry branch and its explosive devices branch had the expertise to create lethal materials and delivery mechanisms. TSS had previously developed poisons as part of the U-2 program in the mid-1950s and impregnated needles for pilots to carry as an alternative to capture and torture. The so-called suicide needle was created by the Devices Branch of the Special Operations Division of the U.S. Army Chemical Corps at Fort Detrick, Maryland, a military research organization with whom the CIA, through TSD, worked closely. The poison on the needle was saxitoxin, a naturally occurring toxin found in contaminated shellfish and one of the most lethal substances known. L-pills had been part of the OSS defensive inventory for issuance to agents on particularly dangerous and sensitive assignments. TSD continued to make those available for CIA operations. Little imagination was required to envision that the same or similar potions could be used offensively as well. Likewise, the guns, bullets, darts, and camouflaged explosives in the TSD inventory for covert paramilitary operations could be considered for use against a specific individual. After the failed Bay of Pigs invasion, President Kennedy and Attorney General Robert Kennedy admonished senior CIA official Richard Bissell, the deputy director for plans, for not doing anything to get rid of Castro. As a result, in November of 1961, Bissell instructed CIA officer William Harvey to direct a program called ZR Rifle, focused on the Cuban problem. From the outset of the Kennedy administration, the CIA had been urged by the White House to create new assassination capabilities, referred to as executive action, the magic button, or even the last resort beyond last resort, and confession of weakness. The CIA attempted to assassinate Castro at the time of the Bay of Pigs invasion, but it disintegrated into a Keystone Cops comedy. The plot involved the CIA's Office of Security engaging a former FBI special agent turned private detective, Robert Mayhew, to recruit members of organized crime to carry out the assignment. Mayhew contacted a former member of the Capone crime syndicate who hired two mafia members judged to have experience. The plotters faced numerous complications.